Hello and happy Friday. You're listening to Mixture of Experts. I'm your host, Tim Huang. Each week, Mixture of Experts brings together a wide range of specialists to separate the AI signal from the AI noise. We tackle the biggest stories of the week and distill them down to just what you need to know. This week on the show, three top headlines. First, the banks weigh in. Goldman Sachs is out with a harsh report on the future of generative AI, claiming the space still has a long way to go to prove its value. Are the bankers out of touch, or do we think they've got some good points?
Feels like they went from one extreme to the other a little bit, right? Like, I almost feel like there's something in the middle.
Second, AI developer Pietro Serrano is out with Claude Engineer 2.0, which adds a code editor and code execution agents to an already powerful command line interface tool. What does the next stage of coding assistance look like? And who's currently winning in the Anthropic OpenAI matchup?
The interesting thing about Claude Engineer is it's really embraced the agent methodology. It's agentic, it is goal-oriented. And I think that's where we really are going to be going as an industry.
Third, the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA, has launched a lawsuit against generative AI music companies Suno and Udio, claiming mass copyright infringement. How might copyright shape the generative AI space, and what does it mean for the future of training data?
They're not going to get their way, and at some point in time, they're going to have to learn to live with it.
As always, I'm joined by an incredible group of panelists that will navigate what has been another action-packed week in AI. Today, we've got Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer, CTO Customer Transformation, Marina Danilevsky, Senior Research Scientist, and joining us for the very first time, Brent Smolinski, Global Head of Tech, Data, and AI Strategy.
Thanks for having me.
So first up, I want to change a little bit of what we do typically, and I want to ask you all a yes or no question, and then we're going to actually dive into the story of the week, which is the Goldman Sachs report. And the question is this: is AI a bubble? Chris?
No, definitely not.
Marina. Marina, what do you think?
AI, no. Generative AI, a little bit.
And Brent, what do you think?
Yes, sort of.
Well, with those extremely definitive answers, let's move on to our story for the week.
Listen, I think if you look back, you know, a little over a year ago when Goldman Sachs first published their article on kind of the impact of that generative AI would have on the market, they predicted something like 7% GDP lift, which is, just as context, that's the size of the North America healthcare market. That's a massive impact. I think now what we're starting to see is in their last publication, they're beginning to backpedal on that.
Yeah, and I think it's a great intro. I think that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I mean, just last week, or I think just a few weeks ago now, Goldman Sachs released its update, Brent, that you're kind of referring to, and they kind of fessed up, right? I think the end conclusion of that report is that the current state of generative AI is, quote, too much spend for too little benefit. And this follows on the heels of some other cautious statements coming out of Sequoia, obviously a prominent VC fund, and McKinsey, which works with a huge number of companies and has been kind of like at the forefront of, I think, pushing sort of generative AI as an enterprise use case. And that's kind of where I want to start today, is just to kind of like go into this kind of moment of hesitation. I mean, I think the last 24 months have been crazy growth in generative AI and crazy excitement. But I think now the industry is kind of like almost thinking a little bit about like, okay, so what happens next? And I guess, Marina, maybe I'll throw it to you next. I mean, one of the numbers that was most striking to me that was kind of cited in the Goldman Sachs report was that, you know, they talked to Darren Acemoglu, who's this kind of prominent MIT economist, who estimates only about 5% of tasks are really genuinely at risk from what's been happening in generative AI. I guess, Marina, do you buy that as an estimate, as someone who kind of works on the technical side of all this? Like, do you see capabilities, you know, really becoming much broader over time? Or really, do you think this estimate is kind of inaccurate of, like, you know, the kinds of tasks that are really going to be at risk in the economy?
I think the state at which the tech is right now, I'm actually not that far off from what he says as well, what Darren says. There's still a lot to be thought of as far as things that we could do with this technology, but it's very clear that we haven't quite thought of it yet. So when it comes to, you know, is it a bubble right now? Yeah, a little bit, as far as the hype versus what the capabilities actually are, what the reliability actually is. I think we need to continue to think. Something that's always really interesting about core technological research is you don't know what the applications are sometimes until sometime later. So it's always very interesting to push those boundaries. But yeah, there's got to be a difference between hype and actual usability, especially when it comes to things that are reliable. At the moment, it's good as an accelerant. It's good to speed up people and tasks that they're kind of doing right now. All right. But that's not enough to
Does it like justify the valuation of NVIDIA as the most, you know, the most valuable company in the world? I mean, I guess, Chris, you know, I think I recall last few times you've been on the show, you've always been our hard-bitten cynic. I don't know if you are agreed with Brent and Marina here, or if you're more of a contrarian, like you actually feel like you're more optimistic than what these bankers are saying. Because what do bankers know anyways?
Yeah. I love the hype. We wouldn't have this podcast if there wasn't any hype. We'd be so no. I enjoy this every few weeks. The hype has to stay. I read the report though, and I think I can't remember who said it, but one of the guys said, nothing's going to happen for the next 10 years. You know, this generative AI is a complete waste of time. And I was just thinking about like back to the 60s when someone said, you know, there's only a need for maybe 5 mainframes in the entire world. And I'm just like, oh my goodness, I wouldn't want to be writing that on that report. I wouldn't want to be quoted in 10 years time being the guy that said generative AI was a waste of time. So now I think it is early, obviously, but the technology is progressing so fast. I mean, I was talking to a customer yesterday and I brought up the models that were popular this time last year, right? And if you think about this time last year, right, Llama 2 just came out. There was no such model from Mistral, right? The Granite models were just out at this point. Claude 2 had just came out, never mind Claude 3.5 Sonnet, right? There was no turbos in OpenAI. So, and we were talking about the Falcon models. We were talking about Vicuna. Nobody talks about these anymore. The everything has moved so fast. And then this year, we're like agents, agents, agents. So if I look at the kind of time frame they're talking about, next 3 to 5 years, 10 years, this industry is moving so fast and the capabilities are getting so much better. I'm happy for them to say it's a bubble because that's going to create more space for people to get on and do the work. So,
like more opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this is not going away. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like they went from one extreme to the other a little bit, right? Like, I almost feel like there's something in the middle. I think one of the analysts said that there's no killer AI application of AI. I mean, that to me seems like an odd statement, right? Because I mean, first of all, we have AI permeates.
ChatGPT.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that's what he meant, right? Like, I think what they're getting at is really when they say AI, they meant large language models, right? But the reality is AI permeates like so much of our applications today. Even in this session that we have right now, AI is being used to do signal processing, clean up the videos, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, AI permeates just about everything we interact, all applications we interact with today. So I don't quite get that statement. I think what he meant was large language models, right?
I know, I agree with you a lot, actually. AI has been around for a very long time and does a lot of interesting and good things. AI just means, hey, the computer's doing something useful. There's some kind of, you know, statistics processing happening. And generative AI is actually a relatively small part of that.
Yeah.
So it's not that fair to take AI and say, okay, this is the only AI that matters anymore. Yeah, it's the one we're paying attention to, but it's actually built on the shoulders of giants in some way. There's been so much work going on for so many decades.
So the relentless march of AI progress, right? It just, you know, the technology continues to evolve and continues to permeate our application landscape in ways people don't even realize. I don't think.
And I think that is something that we like do forget quite a bit, is that, you know, for a long time it was like, what's happening in NLP? Everything's about computer vision. That's the really exciting thing. Or like, everything's about reinforcement learning. That's really how we're going to get to, you know, next generation systems. And then kind of just like everything sort of like flipped in a very unexpected way. It reminds me of this tweet that I saw that I was amazing. So there's this adage in financial markets, which is like the market can be irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And the person's tweet was basically that, like, you know, a sigmoid can stay exponential for longer than you can stay solvent. So like, you know, which I think is just, you know, is like beautiful in some ways. I think one thing I did want to touch on in the report is that it does focus on some interesting potential constraints on growth, which I think are really genuine, right? Like, I think we can debate about how far the tech can go in the economy. But I think one of the most interesting stats they cited was the idea that, you know, per query, the power draw for something like OpenAI is like 10 times the power draw for something like a query like Google. And, you know, it is true that, like, energy is becoming kind of a constraint on these things, right? Like, if you want to run mega, mega, mega clusters, it actually just turns out that, like, in the United States, there's actually like only a few places that have the physical plant that's necessary to do this. And I guess I'm kind of curious if you all sort of buy that is that we may, you know, I kind of buy the argument that like, well, are we demand constrained? It's kind of anyone's guess, but we may very well become supply constrained.
Yeah, I mean, listen, these same kind of arguments were applied with cloud computing like 10 years ago. People were worried about power consumption, yet we're able to build out the infrastructure, solve these power problems. I would argue even the algorithms underlying a lot of these models are improving and becoming much more efficient, which translates into computational efficiency, which translates into energy. So I think these problems will get solved, right? I think in my mind, the biggest problem to figure out is how do I get value out of this, right? Once we kind of began cracking the kind of the AI, the value problem with AI, you know, applying some of these large kind of transformer based architectures to real world business problems, I think that's going to unlock a floodgate of demand, right? And then at that point, we could begin talking about the supply constraint. But right now, I think it's a second order problem to think about, and I'm very confident this problem will get solved.
Marina, I'm curious if I could turn to you as just a kind of a question on a last thought on the story. I mean, is it right to say, maybe the right way of thinking about this, and I don't know if you agree with the statement, is that, you know, there may very well be a bubble in something like language models, but I think we should doubt whether or not there is a bubble in sort of AI writ large. I don't know if you'd agree with that as kind of a way of sort of framing up, you know, what's going on here.
I don't think there's a bubble in AI. I think there's Ecclesiastes seasons. We have winters, yeah. We have summers, and it goes and it goes. So right now there's a lot of attention, but also I'm like, all right, I was doing NLP before it was cool. I'm going to be doing NLP after it stops being cool. Like those of us that are on the ground are just going to continue to push, and that's where these things come from. Sometimes it becomes of interest to people, sometimes it doesn't. To the thing that you had said before, you know, does it make sense to throw a large language model at every single query? Maybe not, but I think right now, because the technology is early, everybody's just seeing, let's see what it can do. Let's test it as much as we can. And it will eventually settle into, it's no longer a hammer in search of a nail. It'll settle into something that we're just as comfortable with as with search when it first started being a big thing. And everybody's like, oh, we're done. No more information organization necessary. We've solved it. No, but it's very, very useful nonetheless. So yeah, I think we're in a season. The season will pass.
So for our next segment, I think the thing I really wanted to focus on was that there's a cool little thing that was being passed around Twitter fairly recently. So Pietro Scirano, who's this AI engineer and kind of a serial entrepreneur based out in the Bay Area, just updated a project that he maintains, an open source project called Claude Engineer. And it's basically an open source project that allows coders to use Claude 3.5 Sonnet from the command line. And, you know, what I love about this project is that there's a bunch of kind of creative features running under the hood. You know, he's playing around with agents and he's playing around with just like a bunch of these kind of like little quality of life improvements. And, you know, again, this is not a big release from an Anthropic or an OpenAI, the kinds of things that we've talked about in the past. But I do really think it's kind of interesting because, you know, I think we've been so locked into like Copilot as like thinking about how coding assistance works with generative AI. And I think what Claude Engineer is playing around with is to say, well, actually in the future, we might want to do more than just like predictive code, like kind of like Stack Exchange on demand, basically. And so, you know, I guess, Chris, I see you nodding. Maybe I'll go to you first is, you know, as I'm wondering if you can explain to people who are listening who are maybe non-expert, not coding day in, day out, like, what is the kind of promise? Do you see anything sort of interesting in what's happening with Claude Engineer? Like, what does the future of kind of coding assistance with AI look like? And if there's like particular things you think are cool in the engineer product or project or otherwise, just be kind of curious about how you think this kind of whole interface evolves.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what he's done with Claude Engineer. It is so simple. It is literally just a command line application. You run it in the terminal in VS Code, so no extensions or anything like that. You put in your Claude key, and then it uses all of the tools that you would normally have with agents running in the background. So you give it a task, a goal, and then it can create folders on your machine. It can go and create entire files, and then it can stitch that all together to help you build entire applications. And when I think about this for a second, Copilot is very typically a kind of prescriptive model in the same way as we chat with our interfaces. But the interesting thing about Claude Engineer is it's really embraced the agent methodology. It's agentic, it is goal-oriented. And I think that's where we really are going to be going as an industry. So rather than me sitting there typing in a couple of letters, you know, waiting for Copilot to come back for a response and then gives me a bit of a code segment. I don't like it. I delete it. And then I sit and pause again. You know, the Copilot pause is going to go away and we're going to give these agents goals and tasks and they're going to come back and help us build into our applications and really sort of start to orchestrate and build workflows there. And what's really going to happen? I love Claude Engineer, but I suspect Copilot's just going to steal all of that and build it into their extension anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, yeah, that is one really interesting element of this is like how much projects like this can survive going forwards because they just get absorbed directly into the product. I guess, Chris, maybe if I can kind of turn the screw one more time, I think there's one sort of comment that you just had there about basically like Copilot being very prescriptive in nature. And do you want to talk a little bit more about that? I guess what you're kind of saying is that like when you use Copilot, it literally recommends the code that you should be using as an engineer yeah. versus, I guess, where you're contrasting here with Shirano's project is more just that like you're specifying more of an objective and it's kind of like assisting you in getting to that objective. Is that the distinction you're trying to point
exactly.
out?
Exactly. It's assistive as opposed to agentic. So when I'm in Copilot, I will type a comment or the first couple of letters and then I kind of wait. So it's not giving me an end-to-end goal. It's not building me an entire application. It's really just a smart IntelliPrompt, to be honest, right? So it's then just going to complete the piece of code that I'm writing. So maybe deal with it at a function level. It might deal with it at a line level. Whereas in an agentic approach and with Claude Engineer, it's starting to scaffold entire applications and entire workflows and orchestration. And that's a completely different mindset from what Copilot has today. And I think that's the big shift that's happening. Again, it's really simple. It just runs on a command line. It's beautiful. But I think a lot of people are going to riff off of that and we're going to get tons of tools. And I'm excited.
Marina, I'm curious if you have any thoughts kind of on where some of this goes. And in particular, I was sort of interested because, you know, what's cool about it is I think what Chris is kind of coming back to over and over again, which is sort of like, it's just in the command line, right? Like, it's almost like unfancy. It's like, and we don't have to make a big deal about the AI being part of your coding experience. It's just like in the command line. But I'm kind of curious about like, what else you think might be coming down the pike with this kind of project. In particular, you know, I think one of the reasons I think we were excited to have you on the panel for this episode is like, you know, starting to combine stuff like, okay, well, we have agents and then we've also got RAG and then we've got, you know, there's a bunch of things that you think you can start to connect together. And just like, kind of curious about how you think like, you know, these types of patterns go going forwards for coding assistance.
Two directions. One is by engineers for engineers, which this is a much more of a by engineers for engineers thing. Like, why do we have IDEs? Why do we have more than one? A lot of these things really got created by people because they say, look, I know my workflow better than you know my workflow. I'm going to create tools that work for me. Other people are then going to be able to make use of it and say, yeah, that's great. People used to have the, you know, Emacs versus Vim fight. Now we have, yeah. you know, Eclipse versus VS Code versus whatever. But it really, most of those features do come from people saying, this is something that's helpful to me and I'm going to do it. So that's where this project sort of falls for me. On the flip side, when you start to be able to combine things, we might finally have something interesting going on in the low code, no code space, which up to now has been like, isn't it great? We can, you know, arrange some visual blocks and you stick it together. And that's like programming.
It's and you're not. Like programming.
You're programming now. Yeah. No, you're not. So we might actually be finally seeing something kind of interesting there. Although again, the persona is different. So you do have to design different things. But this goes to the fact that most of these things really come from, I think, individuals. For even if Microsoft adopts it later, it's still the people on the ground that come up with the idea and go, okay, this is what actually works, guys. Here, do it this way. That's where, you know, that kind of innovation comes, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this creating like a new generation of endless nerd fights that are like Vim versus Emacs. But
yes. You know, so. Dating myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Brent, I guess I'm curious if you want to zoom up for us a little bit and kind of talk about this in the context of the broader competition, right? So I see this as kind of like, you know, at least for me, I think the vibe shift has been Anthropic is now ahead of OpenAI a little bit, right? Like that they're the cool cats. They're doing the really interesting things. But I think a big part of the battle is like what we're seeing here with Claude Engineer, right? Is like, are third-party engineers being like, this is so cool, I'm going to design my own third-party product on top of like the services these foundation models are providing. And yeah, just kind of curious about your take here about like this evolving competition between OpenAI and Anthropic, I guess ultimately for the hearts and minds of like engineers that are producing, you know, code out there in the world. And if you've got a feeling on like who's winning, who's advantaged, who's up, who's down.
Well, it certainly feels like things are shifting towards Anthropic and cloud. That's for sure. I think a big part of it, I mean, is the economics, the cost effectiveness of these cloud models is they're significantly more cost effective than OpenAI. And so with many of my clients, they're actually moving away from OpenAI towards Claude for that very reason.
That's really interesting.
All I do have to say is we recently did an engagement with the senior executive team at one of our clients. And the team developed this amazing prototype. It was an RFP generator. And they were able to develop this in like 3 weeks some incredibly short period of time. And it was a very powerful, you could almost use it to generate these RFPs. There was a few tweaks you'd have to make at the edges. And I think everybody was blown away by how quickly they were able to pull this application together. And again, a lot of it, they built this on cloud using a lot of these code generation tools as well.
Well, I'm going to move us to the final segment of today. And I apologize, as a person who trained as an attorney, I'm always like watching the legal side of all this. And so I was very curious to see and get the opinions of the panel on a story that just happened a few weeks back. The Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA, is basically sort of the music industry's representatives, lobbyists, advocates in the United States. And they launched a high-profile lawsuit against two companies, Suno and Udio, which are these two companies that are in the generative music space. So kind of the idea, if you've played around with a product like Suno, you download the app, you basically say, I want a song that matches the following characteristics, and it just generates the song. And it's actually quite good. And Presage is this kind of really strange world where you're just like, you know, you like Taylor Swift? Cool. You can just get, you know, in 100 hours, 1,000 hours of Taylor Swift sounding noise, basically, going forwards. The RIAA sued both of these companies, essentially claiming copyright infringement, right? And a big part of their claim leans on the fact that these companies are training on music that are ostensibly owned by rights holders. And so we're about to see this big showdown. You know, similar versions of this lawsuit have popped up around OpenAI and Anthropic and other companies. But I think this is the first time we've seen a really high-profile one happen around music, which I think is very interesting. And I think the other thing that's very interesting to me is, you know, how it's going to evolve, right? Like, you know, for example, in the book space, right, for like Kindle, you know, like I feel like there was a period of time where basically, you know, the kind of like piracy didn't really kind of take off. And so we have certain norms around ebooks that we don't have around, say, music. Right. And I think basically, you know, we're starting to see that evolution happen around different generative AI applications. And I guess, Marina, I kind of want to toss it to you is like, as someone who's kind of a researcher in the space, training models in the space, you know, I think the big question for me is, you know, how do you think about these kinds of lawsuits, right? Because I think there's one point of view, which is, well, look, if the RIAA gets its way, there's kind of no way to do these products just because of the sheer number of music files you need to put into these kinds of models to get them to have high performance. Do you think that's the case? Or am I kind of like overstating the risks here?
I mean, I think this, as usual, is going to revolve around discussions of fair use and derivative information. And if you train on the music, just as if you train on the text, and then you throw it away and you just keep the features and the weights for the model, what if that counts? What if it doesn't? But I, first of all, again, cat's out of the bag. People are going to do it anyway. So you got to figure out a way to do it. Second, this reminds me of, you know, discussions of, well, what if somebody posts something on the internet platform? I'm going to misremember what the legal thing is. It's the DM something or another of like...
Oh, DMCA. Yeah, the
DMCA,
copyright.
Yeah. Thank you. Of the like, you can't sue me just because somebody put something bad on my platform. I don't know. It just reminds me of the same kind of thing where people are going to continue to do the technology. You're going to have to find a way around it. The RIA is going to push for what they're going to push for. They're not going to get their way. And at some point in time, they're going to have to learn to live with it, because again, you can't stop people from doing it. That's
It does remind me a little bit of the early 2000s, right? Where, you know, Napster came up and file sharing became a thing. And the RIAA did the same thing, which is like high profile lawsuits against file sharers. Right. And then, you know, I guess Marina, to your point, it didn't really stop file sharing.
But it also didn't break the music industry, right?
Uh-huh. That's right.
So I think the RIAA or whatever their acronym is going to wipe apart Sona and UDU. They are going to win this. So I spent this morning reading that, and they went after the angle that I thought they would go after, which is, of course, they were going with the inputs, but if you look at the actual complaint, they focus in on the outputs, the individual songs. So they brought up, I think one of them was kind of Chuck Berry's Johnny Be Good, and then they brought up some other one in one of the other complaints, and they brought up the kind of the musical chords, and then they were like, this has this style, and this has this style, these notes are identical, and this is why they're going to win. And the reason it's going to win is there's prior cases, and Tim, you can speak about this a lot more, where you've seen like the Ed Sheeran case where he had to prove that he didn't steal from this one. And then there was that one where I think the Verve had stolen some lick from like the 1960s and they couldn't play their song for however long. And so there is prior on not being able to use outputs that have got similar chords, got similar musical progressions. And they're going to hit them with that, and they're going to win, and there's literally nothing they're going to be able to do about it. So even if you don't win on the, if you make the fair use argument that you make with books, that's not going to hold true on the outputs, because you're just going to point to prior case law and say, well, actually, this was a copyright infringement, this was a copyright infringement, and then you're going to have to pay for all of those outputs. So what will probably happen with generative AI there is they're going to have to then start to check the outputs of songs to see it doesn't infringe existing songs. So I think it's going to get super messy, but they're going to win big style.
Yeah. And I think that the messiness, I think, is really interesting because, you know, I used to do a bunch of work and still do around trust and safety on AI, right? And there you're trying to say like, well, we're going to use RLHF and we're going to create all these mechanisms to try to like constrain the behavior of the model, right? And a lot of what you learn is basically like anything you try to do to kind of like prevent model behavior or like block the impermissible behavior, there's lots and lots of ways of subverting, right? Particularly against sort of like a user that's adversarial. And I think part of the worry that I have here is, sure, you know, you're setting up a world where it's like, look, your model can output stuff that sounds almost exactly like this copyrighted training data. But then basically you're saying, okay, company, now you're responsible for preventing that. And I guess I would ask the question of like, is that actually possible? Like, I think from a technical standpoint, like we don't have a whole lot of examples of being able to kind of like really categorically block. Or in the very least, it kind of begs the question, when is an output so close to the training data that it really should be a copyright violation? I think that's kind of an open question.
I think it's a hard thing, right? Because there's so much music, but they don't, as far as the record companies are concerned, it doesn't matter for them. They're just going to sue each, anytime they find an infringement, they're just going to sue the company, right? And it's going to be so difficult that it's not going to be worth anyone's while. So I think it's going to be interesting and hard. I think this case is different. Maybe it turns out not to be the case, and maybe we'll generate so much music and maybe synthetic data will actually be the solution to this, because you just therefore invent a completely new style of music that isn't based on the past. And then the outputs are not going to infringe. Maybe that's the solution, but it's definitely going to get messy. I just don't see these companies surviving it.
Maybe not these two, but I think the actual technology is going to survive. They might kill these two, but I agree with what you said in the end, actually, Chris, which is, okay, so you find some way to figure out what is a dissimilar enough distance between music that it's okay. And you just do that by looking at all the music that's out there and saying, well, these two are, you know, this far apart, so you can't say anything. There's already been years and years and years of study for this. We've got Pandora and Spotify, and how do we do radio, and how do we do recommendations and all the rest of it. We've got an embedding space to work with. We've got things to do there. So they'll just keep pushing to the point of that it's absurd to have the RA complain about a really specific thing. And then that's where we're
going to
be.
Spot on, Marina, right? That is the way around this, because then you get to make the fair use argument again, because you're saying, well, I'm sampling these different cases. I'm not infringing anybody's copyright. So I totally agree. I think we're going to end up with a new style of music, and that will be the interesting thing.
Chris, you know, you bring up a very interesting, you know, argument, and I, you know, the question I have is how creative can these platforms actually be? What do they, is what they create truly original, or can it truly be original? And then the other question I have too is, you know, this platform providers, you know, they're just platform providers, right? And so is the question around, you know, should these platform providers be held liable for these, you know, for the content that's created, or should it be the people creating the content?
Yeah, for sure. And I think we will see eventually stuff like, I mean, on YouTube right now, there's this really interesting thing, which is a form of content ID. So the idea is, well, if you want to use copyrighted music, you can have it in your video. And basically, there's like a royalty that gets paid out if it's detected that you're using this kind of audio. And so there kind of could be really, these really interesting models that sort of emerge where it's like, well, you know, you're allowed to do, you know, a Katy Perry sound alike. Like, she just gets some kind of paid off. And then, I mean, you know, Marina, to your kind of comment, the really interesting question ends up being, well, how do you figure out the compensation based on its closeness in the embedding, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. is this 10% Kanye, 30% Katy Perry, 10% Taylor's? Like, very how would we actually go about, like, designing that kind of embedding space is going to be, like, a super, super interesting engineering problem. Mm-hmm. So as usual, we have more things to talk about than we have time to talk about, but we are out of time for today. So Chris, Marina, Brent, thank you for coming on the show. As always, it's an awesome discussion, and we'll have to have you all back at some point. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere, and we will see you all next week.